Those days add up to this day, and now nothing is the same. Someone once pointed out to me that the entire catalog of the Beatles' studio albums is less than 8 hours of music. 7 years of work runs to about 8 hours. You could listen to their artistic oeuvre in one workday, a morning and an afternoon. It's true, you can as well see the Mona Lisa in the time between two blinks of the eye. But for millions of listeners, that one day of Beatles music is like 1,000 years of evolutionary change in their personal lives, their career paths, their culture, their politics, and even for some, their faith. The British invasion was that influential. It was that momentous. Scott Calhoun, series editor. Introduction. Atlantic Crossing. July 29, 1981. A momentous day for Britain. The wedding of Prince Charles to Lady Diana Spencer had effectively brought the country to a standstill. A public holiday had ensured that the roads were empty. This was convenient as my parents drove me down a deserted M1 to London, for I was heading west, to America, unaccompanied, on the trip of a lifetime. Like many young Britons, I was most definitely not transfixed by the national celebration in my own backyard. I had nothing against Charles or Diana. It was just that their union failed to excite me. In fact, I was supremely indifferent to every aspect, every little detail, relating to the royal wedding. When the day arrived, I did have particular cause to be distracted from my patriotic duty, to take an interest. I was 15 years old when I visited the United States for the first time. Crossing the Hudson into Manhattan, the cityscape set before me was thrillingly modern, thrown into sharp relief on that of all days in its pointed contrast to the feudal celebration I had left behind just 7 hours earlier. It was all simultaneously alien and familiar, as it would have been for any Briton raised on a full-fat diet of Americana, as it would have been for the Beatles themselves when they made an identical, though more momentous, journey from JFK to the city center 17 or so years earlier. When, despite the fervor of the American welcome and the avid attention of the media, the people who were the most excited on that first day in New York City were the Beatles themselves. It was like a dream, Paul McCartney observed, the greatest fantasy ever. Just like McCartney and hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of Britons before and since, I had been to America in my mind way before I actually visited. And chief among the rocket fuels that fired this journey to an imaginary America was its popular music. It was this music that had enabled me to build my altar, supplying an array of texts for worship. From the classic rock and roll of the 1950s to the heavier stuff of the 60s and 70s, from the sounds of Motor City and Memphis to Philly soul and disco, from the art rock of the Velvet Underground to the new wave of Talking Heads, The Cars, and Blondie. Here were hymns to America, which, from Route 66 to Union City Blue, provided the images, textures, and messages that resonated. This music was propulsive, physical, progressive, romantic, modern, and optimistic. An intoxicating set of tendencies, particularly when set in opposition to the bloodless provincialism and parochialism of young English lives that, as the royal wedding had proven, had not really budged all that much, if at all, in the years between my first trip and McCartney's. I wanted to find America in all its different colors and horizons. That's been my trip, explained former Led Zeppelin frontman Robert Plant in a recent interview. I never inhaled a chemical after 1977, but I'm still inhaling America. Musically, writes Andrew Blake, the 20th was the American century, characterized by an overwhelming sonic Americanization. Generations of British youth would have absolutely no argument with this, presumably finding themselves in fervent agreement with John Lennon's proud declaration that, "I've been half American ever since I first heard Elvis on the radio."